Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
Okay, let's get going then. Let me just turn this down. Okay. Right, we all ready to go?
Yeah, we're all ready.
All right, okay. Okay, let's start then. Do you want to introduce me, or do I introduce you, or what?
Yeah, I can introduce you, that's fine.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Let's start now. Let's treat it as though we're starting off.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, so... So tonight we have with us Mr. Ray West, the owner and creator of the website big-lies.org. It's a pretty extensive website. It's got a lot of information about pretty much everything you can think of. So I'd like to welcome Mr. Ray West. How's it going tonight?
Hello. Fine, thanks. I'm speaking now. It's in daytime, isn't it? I'm near Liverpool. I'm broadcasting from near the Beatles country, in fact. Okay, thanks for getting me in touch. I want to make it clear that I haven't really planned this very carefully. I've made a rough outline on the theory that spontaneity sometimes works better. I hope that'll work. Let me just say to people who have not heard of me, I've got several websites. There's biglies.org. I call myself re-revisionist as one word. So if you want to get in, the easiest way to find me is to Google re-revisionist and YouTube, or re-revisionist and Amazon, or re-revisionist and Big Lies, this kind of thing. That'll get through to me. And I have quite a number of things online. There's also a website called Nuke Lies. That's one word, NukeLies.org, which is a frozen forum. It was recorded in 1 year, from March 2011 to March 2012. And it's probably, I think, as far as I know, it's the best. It's still the best introduction and survey of nuke revisionism. That's both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Okay, over to you for a second.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's one thing I've always been interested in, but I didn't feel I had the background or the knowledge to really explore that situation with the nuclear weapons,
yeah,
not being what they seem to be.
Okay, it is quite a technical issue, or at least it looks it. I mean, I've got quite a lot of background in science and in maths and various subjects. I've kind of kept learning ever since I went to college, I went to a university in England, a place called Leicester, which actually is not very highly thought of, with good reason, actually. I mean, most universities around the world are pretty crap these days, aren't they, to be honest? I think you'll agree. Let me just...
Right.
Yeah. It's sad, isn't it? Anyway,
yeah.
Let me just give an outline of nuclear... revisionism. I'll try to include the lead up to the Second World War and then post 1945 and Cold War stuff. And of course, I'm going to emphasize the Jewish element here. And now, well, everybody knows, I suppose, nuclear physics started more or less in 1900. And there's various things, including Einstein, who was in a good position to plagiarize stuff. He was a clerk, a patents agent. I think he was a phony. I think a lot of people are turning around to that view, but it's not really part of the essential message. By the time the Jews got the Federal Reserve in 1913, they were in a good position to dish out money wherever they felt like. And of course, and start the First World War as well. Anyway, after the First World War, Jews started to get involved a lot, and the Manhattan Project was actually mostly... This was before and after the start of the Second World War. The Manhattan Project was mostly run by Hungarian Jews. They were chemical engineers. For some reason, which I'm not sure of, Hungary had quite an output of chemical engineers. They may have been plagiarizing off Germans, I suspect. I'm not certain about that. But of course, Hungary had an abortive Jewish revolution under Bela Kun in, I think it was 1917 or so, which luckily was trodden on eventually. Anyway, the point about the Manhattan Project was that it was kind of promoted through the media in the way that Jews do, and the invention of the atom bomb, it was invented as a kind of myth. It was a story, and it's not clear to me whether anyone involved actually genuinely believed in it, but a lot of the people involved, of course, were Jews, including people like Hermann Kahn, the chap who wrote about megadeaths after the Second World War. And the myth could not have been established without U.S. control of media in Japan. You know, Japan was very heavily censored. The Japanese themselves didn't think they were nuked. They had to be told. And there's other suggestive things. For example, Stalin died soon after the supposed H-bomb test in the Soviet Union. I think he twigged, actually. That's my suspicion. But anyway, they had to have periodic scares. The main point of it was to pretend that the USSR had nuclear weapons, which would keep out any chance of their, you know, mass murders in the concentration camps in Russia being found out, because there were tens of millions of them who were killed off. As many people know now, partly through Sakharov and people like that, not Sakharov. God, what's the name of that chap? I'll have to cut this out, won't I? What's he called? What's the Russian chap who's been censored called?
Oh, I know who you're talking about. I can't think of his name right now, though.
Okay, never mind. Anyway, that's the point of the bomb, was to pretend that the USSR was heavily armed. That's still true today. I mean, Israel pretends to that they can implement a Samson option. In my view, that's a fake, which Jews may come to regret, since they showed that they were perfectly happy to kill off other people, and they might well get the same back to them. Anyway, crisis could be matched with the Cuba crisis was another thing that was made up. They had this business of ships on the sea and so on. And you have to understand that Jews were in control both of the USA and the Soviet Union, where these things counted, and of course Britain as well, Britain and France too. They all supposedly had nuclear weapons. That's the summary of it, really. All this stuff about the Cold War zone was manufactured by Jews and controlled by Jews. All the various so-called research centres were run by Jews. And Edward Teller is a typical example. He was a Jew. He had a reputation of being very, unpleasant and disagreeable. And it was necessary for him to have that reputation so that he could sack anybody he felt like. That is to say, he would get rid of non-Jews, and he could pretend it was a personality clash, you know, that kind of thing. So that if people are not used to this kind of thing, I would ask them and sort of plead with them, suggest to them, they look at nukelies.org online, and the first page there, the opening page, is a list of forums. There are about 12 of them, basically in importance order. The first one is an introduction to the whole question of whether nuclear bombs exist. And number 5 is the one about Hiroshima and Nagasaki giving evidence that they weren't bombed, including all kinds of personal information and bombing information and what have you. And number 7, option 7, there is the nuclear power doubts, because once you start to question this kind of stuff, you look at nuclear power. But anyway, I would urge people to read this stuff up. It's quite complicated, although once you get the feel, once you can thread through it, it's not that complicated or difficult. Anyway, that's nuclear revisionism. I don't want to make a big issue of it. There's such a lot of detail, and most people aren't even at square one. One of my videos actually is completely sort of genuine. It's made of me asking people if they've heard of the idea that nuclear weapons don't exist, and there are 10 or so people. None of them have really had that. Some of them have heard the conventional idea. There's a chap there, in fact, who by chance was serving in Maralinga in Australia, who claimed to have been there. But generally speaking, it's like with the Holocaust. Most people just haven't got a clue, in my view, although it's spreading, of course, but it's still spreading painfully, slowly. Okay, that's the first thing. Now, another point I want to make, which is really very important, is this business of separating out Jews from non-Jews, because Jews have insinuated themselves, they've infiltrated into most countries, and they form a kind of layer on top, sometimes called an elite, although of course they weren't elected, they networked with themselves and inserted themselves into it. And the sequence really was Europe first. It started in Europe, and then Poland and Russia. It started. The nerve center was basically Eastern Europe. So these areas started. Then they moved, as the Americas were discovered, they moved out west and finally into America. Being, if you're parasitic, you're not interested in newcomers, in new states. You wait until they're built up. And I think that's one of the reasons that people in America are not as familiar with this idea of Jews as they are in Britain, which is fair enough. And that's also one of the reasons that a lot of them think that Britain, London, the city of London, controls the world, that kind of thing, which there's more truth in that than I'd realised, actually. I'd assumed that US money was the big thing, but there is a lot of evidence, of course, that it was organised from Britain and also Germany while it was a sovereign power. Anyway, the point I make it here is separating out Jews from non-Jews. When people talk about US policy or our government or our policy, this kind of thing, or us, what we're doing in such and such a country, a lot of people just don't understand that there's a separation. The Jews have a different attitude, a different policy, different aims than other countries do. To give you an example, which is also on my website, the Vietnam War, Jews had a different policy, which was completely separate, nothing to do with American with ordinary Americans. And in my view, the Jewish policy there was to try to make money, for one thing, by owning arms factories and the people that made aircraft and also built bases, all this kind of stuff. They could make money out of that because by then they would, you know, they owned these companies. So there's partly making money out of bombing people. There's also the aim, which is more abstract, which I'll have to talk about later. It's more kind of invisible. It's more under the radar, which is the idea of controlling their monetary system. You know, if you control people's currencies, then of course you can make money out of it the Jewish way, and of course that's one of their aims. So, and this is why. So a lot of people talk about U.S. policy in Vietnam. They're puzzled about it. They can't see what was going on. What were they doing there? And the point was they were patsies of Jews. They were being used by Jews. And once you realize that, and of course it makes things a lot easier to follow. Exactly the same thing happened in Russia. A lot of people still call the Soviet Union, which was the Jewish version of Russia, they still call that Russia, as though Russians were in control. So that's important to separate them out. And let me give you another completely different example. I'll try to have different examples so as to kind of spread things out a bit and sort of triangulate things. But feminism is another thing, which a lot of people don't realize is, in the modern American sense, is a Jewish thing. Now, feminism started maybe in the 19th century, probably earlier, when women felt they were underrepresented, no doubt correctly or probably correctly. But the Jewish version is different. The Jewish people who don't understand this don't realize that Jews who are feminists don't want normal families. They don't want people to have happy families. They want to have abortions. They want to have poisoned kids. You know, they want to have vaccinations. They want to have aliens invading and things like groping and rape as a policy. They want blacks to rape white women. They hate whites. And a lot of people cannot understand that, and they spend years and years discussing, you know, anti-white laws, anti-marriage laws, and this kind of thing. And there was a chap in England who has the world's only male party, Justice for Men and Boys, it's called. And I emailed him. I said, look, if you don't understand about Jews doing this, you'll be wasting your time. And he emailed back and said, you know, I moderate the comments here, and I won't publish comments like that. And I emailed back and said, well, I'm just trying to prevent you wasting your own time. And I think he may have got the point of that, actually. He's trying to oppose male circumcision, which I don't think a Jewish agent would do. I think they're unlikely to take that view. But anyway, so all this stuff about, you know, same-sex marriage and these ridiculous gender things and being, you know, fat, not mattering, all this kind of stuff is basically hostility of Jews to whites. And once you understand that and you separate out the Jewish thing from the sort of perfectly sensible feminism, you understand it properly. And another example is the idea of democracy, which in its present form started in the 19th century, didn't it, in various forms. But what Jews mean by democracy is Jewish control of the media. If they control the media, then they can make there's easily enough control to get people to vote the way you want, and they control both sides or three sides or whatever it is. So that's what democracy means in their sense. And if there was genuine democracy under Hitler, I mean, not before Hitler, he got more votes, as far as I know, than any other politician's ever had, or, you know, something like that. And of course, that's not what Jews mean by democracy. So again, if you separate out the interests of normal people from what Jews think of being their own interests, then you can see the difference. Now, you have to understand also that, at least in my view, that there's a genetic component here. You know, Jews have inbred for many generations. Even if you accept the Khazar theory, which I do, in fact, they've still had plenty of time to inbreed, and they have. I think it's almost an impulse with them, or it may actually be a genuine impulse with them to hate whites. If you read novels and things about, but written by Jews, they just all the stuff about whites is unpleasant and disagreeable and stuff. It's just the way they do it. It's just part of their attitude. Has to be understood, or it does if you want to understand the world. Here's another example: is this immigration business where you separate out Jews from non-Jews. For example, Enoch Powell is famous in Britain for talking about the River Tiber foaming with blood, you know, the rivers of blood speech. And what he said was, we must be mad to do this, we, as though it was a policy of ordinary Britons, which of course it wasn't. The immigration thing was fomented, arranged by Jews. And the same sort of thing with Merkel. I mean, Merkel, as I understand it, is a Polish origin Jew. I mean, in other words, a Jew, an ancestor of Jews who lived in Poland for many generations. Poland had more Jews than almost anybody in the world at one point. So she's a descendant, isn't she? Not an ancestor. When she says, you know, we, Europe, must take more immigrants, more non-whites, she doesn't mean we. She's not including Europeans generally. She's talking about Jews. It's their policy to ruin Europe if they can by importing inassimilable aliens. That's what they do. There's something similar with the British Empire. But when Britain was flourishing, when it had an empire, they all talked about the British empires. But in fact, the Jews drove it. The Jews must have been behind the scenes there. And I think there was a kind of separation of interest there. I think the Jews grabbed the assets. They grabbed whatever it might be, diamond mines or industries that were available there. But the British, although they provided the military force behind it, it was only a small force. The British did things like built railways and, you know, arranged water systems, which are still there. I mean, Victorian railways are still kept going in India. And they have all these sewage and water systems, which are still running. And I think this accounts for the double standard here. You know, a lot of people felt that the British were doing there to rip them off, but in fact I suspect that it was Jews rather than the Britons, although it's hard to know. You can't be too sure about this kind of stuff. And a very important point is that with internet, which I personally date from about 1997, after internet, it's had the same effect as archives being opened. You know, these archives, every few years they open, you know, like 30 years earlier or 40 years earlier. But now with internet you can get hold of family networks and get photos online, which were previously very hard to get to, and Jewish surnames, that kind of stuff. So it's had this tremendous effect of opening up the archives, which I'll talk about later. That's part of the general solvent effect that internet has had and is having, and I hope will continue to have. Okay, are you following me so far?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Okay, let's discuss here a bit Jews' operating procedures. You have to remember that they have their own sort of little educational system with their own books, their own classics, their own sort of dictionaries and people they quote, that kind of thing, and their own canon of standard works like the Talmud, that kind of thing. And they also have their own parables and things where just one name can stand for an entire operation. You know, they just quote somebody like Purim was supposed to have been a thing in Persia. You know, they were proud of having supposedly destroyed Persia. I don't know how true that is. And there are similar stories about Egypt and so on. A lot of this, of course, is in the Old Testament, which I'll talk about a bit later as well. Now, that's kind of obvious enough, but of course a lot of people don't know this. The people who ought to know, I mean, in England there was a whole set of people who were called Orientalists who looked into various languages like Syriac and so on. There's a whole load of Eastern languages in the Orient, and of course they might have been expected to have paid some attention to this kind of stuff in the same way that classicists read up on Greek classics and Latin classics and so on. But in fact, there seems to have been very little of that, unless it's been suppressed, I don't really know. But to give you an example of the kind of thing, there was a good quotation on, it was from the Occidental Observer. There's a chap gave Lazarus an example. You know, everybody knows Lazarus rose from the grave. This chap says that's a misunderstanding of the story. In the story, there was a Jewish practice of leaving bodies for 3 days to check that they're actually dead. You know, you leave them if they still look dead after 3 years, after 3 days. Then, sorry, not 3 years. Then, fair enough. Yeah. But they charge that. They charge a lot of money for this practice. And Lazarus's deed was not so much rising the dead, but rising to so he didn't have to pay rabbis a lot of money for checking if he was dead. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing. These things of Jews are widely misunderstood, and they should be understood. I mean, if people can be bothered, they ought to have a sort of little checklist of these things so you can go through and see, oh, yeah, this is what they've said before. And, I mean, you get this with Hollywood. They rerun. It has two functions, right? They do scene setting. They have, like in the 30s, they had a lot of films about, you know, going to assassinate Germans and how wonderful it was, that kind of thing. So that was setting the scene for the Second World War. But of course, they also rerun things. You have a lot of stuff about, you know, Holocaust, hollow hoax, fraud, that kind of thing. So you have to understand. In fact, any serious person who's into looking at films, film reviews, you know, the film as a subject, should learn to examine these things and see what was the current piece of crap that they were promoting. And this was where it worked with nukes as well. You had Hollywood films about nuclear power stations and nuclear wars and all this kind of stuff. And, I mean, it's still going on. There's a Spielberg film showing, I can't remember his name, you know, the the bloke with the whip, the carpenter with his whip, showing him in 1945 with a fake atom bomb out in the desert in America. Anyway, that's important. If you're looking at anything in the modern world, money or legal stuff or immigration policy or anything, you know, deindustrialization, don't think of it as being an American thing or a Chinese thing or an Australian thing or whatever. Bear in mind there's a Jew aspect to it. And if you understand that, although it's complicated, it kind of complicates things a bit, but once you get the feel of that, you'll things become a lot clearer. Okay, that's in my view anyway. I don't know if have you got any comments on that yourself about...
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true, because I've been doing a lot of research lately on George Soros, and I've been doing kind of a lot of shows on George Soros lately, and he's behind a lot of the destabilization that's going on, primarily in the United States and in Europe.
Yeah, that's right. He funds all these organizations to welcome immigrants, doesn't he? But not in Israel, of course. Welcome them somewhere else. Yeah, yeah. He's it's extraordinary, isn't it? I do think it's genetic. Let's go on to this business of on my website. There's a thing. It's in my Jews section. Got too long. I've separated it out. I've got articles about Jews, which are my articles going back to. I think it was to 2012, something like that. It's with originally they were with a site which is now closed down called the British Resistance, which is quite a good. Anyway, I've got a lot of articles there, including more recent ones on Trump, for example. And there is a piece there somewhere about which I copied actually from before it was deleted. It was a German piece originally about the evolution of Jews, maintaining that people had lived in cities for a few thousand years. The longest place was in Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and the Euphrates. So you've got Babylon and Nineveh and also Egypt. And they had towns for a longer time than anywhere else probably in the world. And so there's scope for a new set of evolutionary types, which are essentially parasitic, with specially evolved, so they were good actors, basically. They could act carefully. They were accomplished liars. They tell lies without any compunction or any really any body language. They could do this, and they were also literate. They had a particular attitude to language, which is very distinctive. They're essentially bullshitters, and they go for a short-term advantage. And it's very skillful. They have been remarkably successful. I don't know if you agree with that. It's debatable. It may be bullshit. There have been other similar groups. I've got some of my Jews file. I've got some stuff about, for example, gypsies are a similar sort of thing, kind of, except they're not so clever. They never evolved reading. They're like Jews would be if they couldn't read and write. And thugs are another one. You get people who are part of a society, but they prey on it. The thugs in India were roving thieves. They would cooperate together, but conceal their motives. They would join up with other groups of them without making any sign. And then when the moment was ripe, they'd kill these people. In fact, with a ritual yellow scarf, they'd strangle them and divvy up their goods and bury the bodies as quickly as they could. I think parasites have a distinct psychology. I think one of the reasons they get desperate is because they feel, in the same way that a cuckoo or a parasitic worm or something might get desperate if all they can do is this kind of stuff. So they don't want to do anything else. They get desperate and they sort of lash out, And does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, and I think that's a lot what they're doing now. You see, they keep pushing all these different aspects, like this transgender concept and all that. And they keep pushing more and more all these different ideas. And this idea of safe spaces, where basically all they're doing is telling people that they're not supposed to speak out about anything.
Yeah, well, they also control things like this. For example, there's this whole anti-white movement aimed at American blacks, telling them that whites are responsible for all these. They slide over the fact that the slave trade was run by Jews. And it's very effective. You can see these YouTubes of these blacks saying that they invented everything and they were robbed. And it's quite entertaining to watch in a way. But
I've seen a couple of those. Those are pretty kind of funny to watch sometimes.
Yeah, but anyway, the point is, if it is parasitic, if it's a genuine genetic thing, then you see they're not... It doesn't matter what reason says. This is, I think, why they continue. They don't sort of stop and think, maybe we're doing the wrong thing. Well, they don't stop and think, look, we've got enough money, let's not bother anymore. It's an impulse to them to hate whites and get sort of dig their teeth in like vampires. So the genetic thing is a serious hypothesis. I'd like to have discussed it with geneticists, but they're a cowardly bunch of people. They're not going to talk about this thing, although it's arguably one of the most important issues in the world, isn't it, really? I mean, if there is a genetic thing which continues like that, you've got a serious problem. You have to do something about it. I think that's another reason why they don't care about competence and skill. They like having unqualified people as judges and professors and presidents. I mean, look at Obama. He's obviously not competent to be a president. But if Jews control the strings, they're not bothered about it. They just assume, in the way that parasites do, that the substrate, their food is going to be there. They're not interested in making sure it is. I mean, you don't get sort of cuckoos carefully going around doing censuses or anything. They just, they're just in it to parasitize. I think there's another very important thing. Anyway, I take that view. I'm a determinist, personally. I think if people knew enough, they could predict the entire future. I don't think there's any exceptions, really. But, of course, in practice, it's just simply impossible to do this. There's just so much, the complications are so great that there's no way you're going to be able to predict things in any sort of detail. But anyway, the point is, if you're going to take the view that there's genetic determinism, then you've got to apply it to whites as well. And, of course, you have to look at them and see they're kind of scattered and whatever the word is, scattered, they're divisive. They kind of tend to fight amongst each other. And a lot of these things are useful adaptations. If you're in Northern Europe, you know, if it's cold and stuff, you have to be experimental. You have to try things out. You have to back your own judgment to some extent. So a lot of the defects of whites are presumably genetic as well, and it may be that whites just won't be able to hold together. They'll just be exploitable. That doesn't seem at all unlikely to me, but obviously I hope that's not the case. Does that make sense to you? Or maybe you have views on that.
Well, yeah, I can see what you're saying, because if you look at, you know, European history, the English and the French fought each other for basically ever.
It's so hard to know, isn't it? Because that's certainly true since, the Dutch Republic, since about 1600. Then there was Cromwell, the French Revolution, invasion of Russia. They didn't like that. And then the Russians were hated by Jews because they wouldn't agree to the Rothschilds running all the money and so on. So the trouble is, we've got such a, although it seems like a long time in geological times, it's not such a long time. So it may be that a more natural state would be not to have wars all the time. It's just I just don't know. I just don't think it's possible to be sure. I mean, if you look, the same in the USA as well. They had the American Civil War, or war between the states, whatever you call it, was the biggest war that there'd been to date, I think I'm right in saying, and with massive destruction and massive evils of one sort or another. But are you saying that would that have happened without Jews promoting it? I just don't know. I suspect not, but one simply doesn't know. Anyway, there's quite an interesting point here, which is to do with a Jewish thing, which is to do with, you see, if you're white, they tend to be sort of hands-on, they tend to sort of play around, they tend to have, I mean, Americans, they tend to have welding equipment, you know, in their garage, don't they? And they play around with routers and saws and handguns, this kind of thing, and play around with their cars, sort of thing. There's a kind of play aspect. With Jews, they tend to be more abstract. There's a sort of, they're like invisibility, you know. If you look at a building, you can see the building. There it is. You can assess it and see you can guess who must have built it and what from. But things like the ownership, you know, documents about it are more or less hidden, and Jews kind of seem to spontaneously go for things where there's concealment, you know, and you can have agreements and treaties and pacts and so on. And of course, most people just don't know about them. And similarly with loans and repayments and penalties, all this kind of stuff. So Jews tend to go for this invisibility sort of cloaking thing, tends to extend to just everyday life as well. You know, they tend to get behind stuff where they can hide in that way. And, of course, do you not agree? And they're sort of, I think that's instinctive too. Unfortunately, of course, it means that if you're white, if you're an ordinary person and you want to study law, you tend to think, oh, this is a bit boring, I'm not that interested. But whereas Jews go into it specifically because they can control other people as a result, they've got more vested interest in it, in the same way that people running their own business tend to work harder than people who are employees. So that's another aspect of Jews. You know, they tend to get into, you know, laws, legalism, documents, and all this kind of stuff. In a way, they're a product of the invention of reading and writing, and early city life seem to have been what formed them. Yeah,
I would actually agree with that, because if you look at what they've done in the past, they basically started with a monetary system and the legal system, and even if you look at the media nowadays, a lot of the Jews actually control the media conglomerates and the networks and things like that, but the people out in front, the people you see, the journalists and whatnot, they're white.
Yeah, that's
majority
right.
Of the time, and the people behind the scenes are completely all Jews.
That's right. They use front people, don't they? And of course, the front people. There's another thing about whites is that they're easy to bribe, aren't they? You can get them. There's loads of these people like that. They're obviously they're paid by what Jews assess to be an above average kind of wage for these people. And of course, they get discarded if they say the wrong thing. But that's right. You have them. I mean, I remember Kevin MacDonald of the Occidental Observer went through that. When he was at college, university, Jews would ask him to front their meetings, that kind of thing. So I think it may be that there'll be some kind of change intellectually over the whole idea of era. You know, do you pronounce it era or era? Era is the American way, is it? E-R-A.
Right.
Okay, anyway, you know, it's obviously, you've got things like the Stone Age and the agricultural revolution or agricultural development, and then the Industrial Revolution, and they're all to do with things, you know, they're not kind of idea-based. I suspect there might be, history might with advantage be reclassified in a more intellectual way. I mean, you do have things like contracts, the age of contracts, which is kind of goes some way towards it. But I hope as these things get penetrated and extend that history will be viewed backwards, you know. Anyway, and I think also that's important because I think the Jews, unfortunately, have got more aggressive. In Europe, there was Cromwell, which I think was a lot worse than people think. It's kind of been elided over, but there was a civil war. Cromwell being supplied with cannon on a scale which was sort of unprecedented, and there were, it must have been there was famine and so on. I mean, there were large scale kind of horrors which are. Which of course Jews aren't going to emphasize. Jews wanted to put Cromwell there, so they don't mention deaths in England any more than they do in Russia. Anyway, so you've got that, and then France had the French Revolution, and of course you've got 1945. But since 1945, they've been more aggressive. I think with on the nuclear site, there's some stuff about Lyndon Johnson, and. Building up huge loans to Jew-owned companies. When Jews make profit out of wars, it's not just a question of owning weapons and selling them at overpriced and this kind of stuff and selling them to both sides. There's also the issue of getting in debt. If they can get a country in debt, then, of course, they can get money paid back to them more or less indefinitely into the future. And I think I've seen it said that Johnson was trying to get the USA in debt by getting planes shot down and so on. And if it was in debt, then Jews can make money that way as well. It's not just the direct things, though there's indirect things. There's also things like drugs as well, prostitution, that kind of stuff, which traditional Jewish activities. And that, of course, has the advantage of killing off Goyim as well. You know. So anyway, I think if you take the view that it's genetic, then it does mean it's a deeply rooted problem, and it's going to sort of continue, and that does look right. And let me just make another point here, which is about the Khazars, which a lot of people don't seem to realise the possibility here. The Khazars were supposed to have been converted. The evidence suggests they were converted in, I think it was 700 or 800 AD, something like that, before Islam anyway, and a long time after Christianity. And their boss said, right, we're going to be Jews from now on. And of course, if you have this thing imposed rather than organically sort of growing, then after a few generations, but I don't know how many, after a few generations, you'll get people who happen to like reading and writing and talking about things rather than doing anything. You'll get rabbi types appearing, and of course, they were encouraged by the state then, so they'd have more kids presumably, and you get threats against other groups. You get all the stuff in the Talmud would start coming out of them. It would be genetically bred in the same way that if you imposed medical books in Africa, the population goes up. It's kind of the similar sort of thing. It's easy to forget the effects of reading and writing because you're so used to it, but if you have things like Talmudic writings and imposed on the Khazars, in my view, after a few generations, they'd be pretty much the same as Jews are believed to be. You know, and it's the fact that they were, from the start, rather self-enclosed. You know, the Khazaria, that area, had river boundaries and also mountains as well, so it was difficult to get to. So I think that Khazars being Jews is perfectly compatible with the genetic theories about Judaism, although a lot of people like David Duke are quite keen to write that off. And I don't know. I mean, I'd have loved to get a serious geneticist to discuss how many generations of selective breeding would produce rabbi types. Interesting. That would be interesting, but they won't. So that's my genetic attitude. I think there's genetics, and I think Jews are the way in which Kevin MacDonald has started to expose in a rather small way. He's too academic for my taste. Okay, so let's go on to fake history.
Actually, there's one point I wanted to make when you were talking there. You were saying, you know, the rabbis could read and write, and they were encouraged to have large families and everything like this. If you go on the opposite side of that coin and talk about Christianity, you had people who could read and write, maybe more intelligent than the normal person, and, you know, they were encouraged to go into the monastery where they were actually celibate and not encouraged to have families at all. And I think that's kind of – I think that was their plan from the outset, because it's basically like a dysgenics program.
That's right. It's absolutely true with priests as well. I mean, certainly in –
right.
In England, they were expected to be celibate right up to, the 20th century, I think. And of course, they got a lot of homosexuals going into it as well, although they tended not to mention it. And I was pretty sure that priests were meant to be celibate on the continent, although a lot of them weren't. The idea was that if you've got celibate priests, they don't... It was deliberately done so that they wouldn't... hand over their livings to their kids. It's called simony. Simony is where you have you're a priest and you have kids and you make them a priest after you. So it was an attempt to deal with that, which of course was not very successful. But yeah, that's absolutely right. It's a genetic thing which ought to be looked at. I've got a theory about the early church, which I'll mention later, which I think is completely new, but it may not be. Anyway, 20th century, let's look at the history. We want to go back. I only became aware of this quite recently, that if Jews can get away, can write stuff out, write history out, then of course they've got a big controlling influence. It's exactly like Jewish, like the New York Times, like these Jewish things, and the BBC, which is largely controlled by Jews. All these things are... You can say what you want, and if you've got no compunction about telling lies, then of course you can invent stuff. I don't think they invent it all. I mean, the countries like Russia and what have you do exist. But, if you look at the 20th century history as Jews put it together, you've got people like Churchill and Stalin as heroes, and they completely ignore famines in, you know, Ukraine or in the USSR, and India for that matter. There were famines during the Second World War. I don't know about the US Dust Bowl. I wonder if that was an artificial famine. I don't know if that would count as it. But anyway, it's Jew-centric. It's all Judeo-centric. Everybody else, you know, doesn't matter. So that's a fairly obvious thing to a lot of people. They're coming round to the view that they've been told lies. If you survey the 20th century, Britain was appeared to have been doing well before, and it's kind of pretty much rubbed out. The same with France and Germany. All these countries had some sort of empire, and it was deleted pretty much. Anyway, but if you understand that and you project it back, you get all kinds of things. Let's start with the Elizabethan England. There was a war with Spain, the Anglo-Spanish War, which may well have been a three-way war with Jews involved. And the idea about Merry England is complete bullshit. There was famine and so on. And of course, at that time, Spain was trying to get rid of both Jews and Muslims at the same time, which they successfully did eventually. It's why I believe that that's why Freemasons have an oath which includes the Quran. Well, it sounds a bit odd. I think at that point, at that time, Jews and Muslims were a kind of mutual support organisation. Anyway, so there you've got the Anglo-Spanish War. This was the time of Shakespeare. I've got a piece by Captain Ward on my website about that, which I took down. This is from rather indirectly via the Shakespeare authorship issue. But anyway, you've got the Anglo-Spanish War, you've got famine, you've got Queen Elizabeth, and then you've got the English Civil War just a sort of generation later. And the Jews must have decided not to back the Tudors or the Stuarts. They got rid of them in favour of Cromwell, and Cromwell, in my view, was a disaster, although they call this the Glorious Revolution. It's a Jewish view of it. Just after Cromwell, the Bank of England... Oh, there was also a Great Fire, which I think was probably a land clearance thing in London. All this is on Nuke Lies. There's a section on Nuke Lies on off-topic stuff. Other revisionisms, hyper-revisionisms, off-topic. Because a lot of things are off-topic, strictly speaking, from the nuclear issue, but they are kind of indirectly relevant. Anyway, so we had all this kind of crap going on, and of course that history is essentially faked. I mean, all the teachers, there are thousands of these people all teaching the conventional stuff, all crap, you know. And anyway, if you fast forward a bit, if you get to the First World War, there's quite a good point here made by, I think it was Miles Mathis, about the Great Gatsby being a sort of optimistic book. The same sort of thing happened in England. There was stuff about Dance, Little Lady Dance. They were trying to, you know, forget, ignore, suppress the effects of the First World War, despite all the deaths, including deaths from pneumonia, for that matter. So they rewrote history. And, of course, the communism was Jewish thing was never faked. That's only started coming out on a large scale since internet, I think I'm right in saying, although there were individual writers who knew what was going on, who have, you can see them on the internet, of course, and I mean they had a hard time of it. They must have been really annoyed with the stupidity of their fellow countrymen, you know. And that happened both in, well, not just Germany, it also happened in France and England. Germany was the only one that got out of that mindset, although, and that's why they were crushed, of course. And well, the Second World War, though, again, that was all kind of rewritten and sanitized. The Good War, that was a Jewish writer, wasn't it, who wrote that so-called history book. And during the Second World War, incredibly enough, Lord Rothschild, there was Lord Rothschild, was the given free access to science secrets. You know, you'd go around investigating things like the magnetron. The cavity magnetron was supposed to have been a major discovery which the British made. I don't know if they did. You know what this thing is with inventions. People all claim to invent things. I did quite a good review, I think, of Spike. I've got some reviews on my, which are quite popular, actually, in my, so I've got about 400 of them, all one after. I put them all in one long file because I read, basically these days most files are about a megabyte, so I've got a whole long file there. Well, it's spilt over that now. Anyway, there's a review of Spycatcher, which reveals all this kind of stuff. Anyway, so, well, it's obvious, isn't it? The Second World War was, all the history has been Jew-washed, you know, whitewashed. And there's something similar happened in the 1960s. This is another example where you have to separate out Jew effects from the US effects, from the vested interests. The Vietnam War did have serious opposition. I've got that on my website. I've got Vietnam War. It was actually a review which Bertrand Russell attempted to. I mean, he's in his 80s or 90s by then. He was very old. He tried to raise this issue. And he was, in fact, it was taken over. It was kind of rounded on by Jews like Isaac Deutscher, who wrote on Stalin, and Chomsky. That was one of the early appearances of Chomsky. Chomsky said, oh, there's some terrible things in Vietnam, but, you know, obviously we Jews have had a mass murder on a scale that nobody else has had. So anyway, let me just go into this business about projecting backwards. I've got a theory about early Christianity, which probably won't be popular with anybody, that it was Jew-free. The word Christianity, it's derived from a Greek word. It means golden or gold-plated, gold-covered. The word chrysalis actually comes from some chrysalids of butterflies. Moths have gold points. So Christian meant originally that it was, you were lit up, you were illuminated, you know, you were, there was a, the light was shining on you or something. That's what it meant. You were a Christian. And presumably it had several components. It would probably have an other life thing, you know. If people live for a short time and are ill often, they like to believe in either life after death or a better life, fair enough. And there might have been stuff taken from Rome, Greece, Egypt, Babylon, all these places. Those, that seems the most likely thing to me. It would have that. It wouldn't have anything Jewish in it, because I mean, why the hell should it? It would be slaves from all around the empire, and some of them educated, some of them, well, maybe some of them Greek. So they'd have, you'd have, that would be Christianity. I presume early Christianity was like that. But if you're a Jew, you think, you know, oy vey, we can make money out of this, we can take it over. And remember, they'd have a couple of centuries, several centuries before Constantine made it an official religion. So all they could do, I'm not saying this definitely happened, but it's perfectly possible that the Old Testament and the New Testament were just kind of muscled in. These Jews said, well, this is our, we're going to stick this in. And the, I don't know how literate people, early Christians, would have been. I suspect the Old Testament was just kind of shoved in there, and the New Testament was shoved in as well. They'd make up some Jew and pretend that he was an early Christian, whereas I'd say almost certainly early Christianity had nothing to do with Jews at all. So I'm hoping, with luck, this revisionist kind of movement will get rid of this whole Jewish thing and kind of hive it off, you know, like a sort of disease thing, like a... you know, in the same way as diseases are kept isolated, and you know, get rid of it, because you get an awful lot of these. You get these naive Americans who say they're Christians, think they're Christians, who don't have any idea about the way this thing has been swung on them. And I would hope, I do hope, they'll kind of get out of it, because they're sitting ducks at the moment. Anyway, this is material about rewriting history, which is, I hope, will become better known. And it's so obvious, really. Once you get the feel of Jews and their procedure, you'll see all this sort of stuff. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that does make sense to me. And I've never really thought of that or heard an idea like that Christianity wasn't entirely Jewish to begin with, and the Jews just kind of took it over time. I never actually heard of that or thought about that. I've always just assumed that it was Jewish from the get-go.
I think that's right. And of course, there are more and more people. There's a Jews for Jesus movement. There's all this kind of stuff, and they're very keen to insist that Jews were there from the start. Whether they really were, I don't believe personally. I just don't see why they should have been. And it may be that the tension between Roman Catholics and Jews, and maybe the Eastern Church, Eastern Orthodox, you know, the stuff based in Constantinople. Maybe the tension between Jews and Christians was a relic of that. Maybe the early Christians didn't accept this stuff. I mean, if you remember the early days of the Church, there were no translations of either the Old or the New Testament. The priests, the experts, didn't encourage anybody to have translations. It only happened in the Middle Ages. And as far as I know, anyway, it's certainly true in Britain. There were people who were tortured and killed for trying to translate the Bible. I think Tyndale was one of the first ones. So that's an interesting point. Perhaps it occurred to me maybe the chap who made the film about the crucifixion, what's his name? I've forgotten his name. Australian actor. Come on, you must know that.
Oh, I don't know. Oh, wait. Are you talking about... No, Mel Gibson's not Australian.
Mel Gibson, yeah. He's Australian. He is.
Is he?
Oh, yes.
I didn't know that.
What was the film he made?
Passion of the Christ.
Passion of the Christ. It was 2004, wasn't it, I think?
It was early 2000s.
Quite a long time ago. Well, he could do... He's supposed to be doing a book now on... Well, it's not a book, sorry, a film on the resurrection. We're thinking about it. So perhaps he could do one on the Bible and make it a Jew-free Bible. That would be a bit controversial, wouldn't it?
Right.
Anyway, I want to talk now about science revisionism, which is an aspect of my website, which in my view is very important. But most of the people who are dealing with this stuff are not, don't have any science background, and they're not interested, and they can't sort of handle it. So this, I think, as far as I know, my site is still kind of unique in looking at this stuff. And I've discussed nuke revisionism already, or in a very scanty outline. But I've also got stuff on physics here, and it's called Modern Physics as a Fraud in Modern Physics, something like that. Modern physics being counted from about the 30s, 20s and 30s, that kind of thing, which incidentally was largely another Jewish thing, in the same way that psychology was largely a Jewish thing, Freud and so on. And I've included a few things there which are quite interesting. There's the speed of light as a limit, which is worth knowing about. They get this conclusion, it's a mistake, came from but you see, if you've got a bullet or something, obviously it's not going to go anywhere near the speed of light. So they switched to using particles. This has been after particle detectors had been invented. You need either things which scintillate or things which will condense water. Anyway, once they invented these things, they tried accelerating particles through them and using magnetism or an electromagnetic field to attract these particles, right? You've got an electron or something, and it goes faster if you accelerate it. But the trouble is, the more power you put in, the electromagnetic field itself goes at the speed of light, you see. So no matter how much power you're going to put in, it's never going to get to the speed of light. It's like pulling something at a 100 mile an hour thing. It's never going to get faster than 100 miles an hour. However, it's not a very good parallel, but maybe you see the point I'm making. So all this stuff based on the speed of light is a mistake, and I've tried to write that out there. I don't know. I think it's had some effect. I've seen people say, oh, they never thought of that. And there's another point about light which is worth mentioning, which is that it's biologically important to people. It's biological to us. You could look around, and of course it's the main sense for telling where you are. And it's a remarkable sense. If you look at things, you can tell, where they are, how much they cost, what color they are, what they like, what they weigh. It's a fantastic device when associated with the brain. I mean, it's far and away the most well-developed sight, a sense in people. But that's biological importance can be sort of, you can get smuggled in. If people had evolved in total darkness, nobody would talk about the speed of light as being an important thing. The fact that the sun, for example, is, I think it's 8 minutes behind the Earth. Although that's true, it's not that important. Nobody would deny that the sun has a fixed position, even if you can't see it directly straight away. And that leads up to the uncertainty principle, which, of course, has been the source of a whole load of bullshit. So I've tried to kind of put stuff in there to common sense-ify it a bit. There's another very interesting point, which I got from a friend of mine called Phil Holland, about cloud physics, which is why it explains, actually, why weather forecasts are crap. He maintains, I think correctly, that clouds have been misunderstood. You think of clouds, the natural way to look at them is as though they're like a sailing ship or something, which gets blown before the wind. But he puts that the other way around. He thinks if you look at the way water vapor is held in air, it's ionic, it's slightly charged. The water molecule is asymmetrical, so you can get chains of them. You can get formations of water vapor. And if that changes its structure, you get huge thermodynamic changes, over vast areas. So he maintains that as these things change shape, it causes wind. So clouds basically are one of the drivers of winds, not the other way around. And he's got a good lot of stuff on that. I haven't put that on, actually. I left that deliberately to see if weather forecasters would say anything. Of course, they don't. They're only interested in collecting their money, basically. Anyway, that's some of the physics stuff on there, and it's all perfectly serious. There's no sort of bullshit in it. Incidentally, it's worth. There are some alternative physics people. There's a thing called the NPA, the Natural Philosophy Alliance, I think it stands for, and there you are. It's perfect example, perfect chance for them, looking at nukes, for them to show how brilliant they are and show that nukes must exist. But of course, they say nothing. There's a general rule of these things. You get people who are exasperated. You get a huge response, like a knee jerk, you know. And then when they see you're serious, they go quiet because they can't answer. That's a general pattern. Anyway, so the natural philosophy answer is a waste of time. Now, anyway, the next thing is biology, and this is all to do with, or very largely to do with, a friend of mine who unfortunately has now died, who was actually a Jew as well, or thought he was a Jew, called Hillman, Harold Hillman. And I've got an interview with him on my website, which I did about 20 years ago now, incidentally, before I knew that the hoax was a fraud, and before I knew nukes were a fraud. Anybody who's interested in biology, a doctor or researcher, ought to listen to it. It goes into why the techniques are wrong, and I'll just mention one of them. The easiest one to understand is electron microscopy, and you're invited to assume with electron microscopy that they get a sample and they sort of stick it under the electron microscope, and there's an image which is just like a light microscope, only, you know, bigger. But that's actually not the case. The electron microscope of that type is where it has to have a vacuum. It's a bit like a cathode ray tube. You have to have a vacuum, and it has to be dried out, otherwise it will explode because the thing heats up under these electrons, under the electron gun. So they dehydrate it, and they have to soak it with heavy metals as well to make the thing show up under what's more or less like X-rays. So it's soaked with these things, it's dehydrated, it's put into plastic and cut thinly. So it's full of what are called artifacts. In other words, there are things in the image which are not in the original. And if you look up any textbook of cell biology, it'll show you a diagram of the living of a cell, and there's a sort of round thing with a nucleus, and it shows all these striations inside. There's supposed to be a network inside, and that is all bullshit, I promise you. It's caused by misreading electron microscopy, and consequently they've got a whole lot of things derived from that which are a mistake. And in fact, it's an interesting point here that some creationists are actually right here. They think they find and they say that there are chemical things or whatever which could not have evolved. This is what the creationists say. They couldn't have evolved, and they're probably right. They couldn't have evolved. But people like Dawkins hasn't understood this stuff, despite being supposedly a popularizer of science. So he just doesn't say anything. You know, he takes the coward's way out. Anyway, so that's quite important. That's just one of the items. If anybody is interested in this, look on my website. Look on the stuff about Harold Hillman and biology, and read it through. Unfortunately, it's too much to go into here, but it's all completely serious. It's absolutely on the button. And I suspect the reason it has not been brought up is because it's entirely possible that the cell is so small that, despite all this stuff about science advancing, that these people have not been able to think of a better technique. In other words, they keep doing this stuff because they haven't got anything better. And it is possible that the techniques needed, if they exist at all, are a matter of patient observation and real-life observation. And if that's the case, then they're wasting their time. And it is also possible that India or China might pull ahead by rejecting all this stuff and devising stuff of their own. In fact, come to think of it, there's a chap called Gilbert Ling. I'm not sure if he's still alive. I suspect possibly not. But Gilbert Ling had his own alternative theories, which are on a similar line to Hillman. Although, unfortunately, I don't think he's a wonderful writer. I think some of his stuff is. I criticised him online. He got a bit worked up about it. So I don't know. Anyway, that's biology. Another thing, of course, with involving Jews is psychology. I mean, Freud has been pretty much kind of demolished. But there are other similar things like brainwashing. There's a connection with Korea. The idea about brainwashing started in Korea. And in my view, this was a deliberate cover-up by Jews of American war crimes in Korea. They had to pretend that these US people who were complaining balloon is, and so they invented brainwashing as something carried out by the horrible Chinese. And there's similar things with my Milgram's experiment. This is obviously a bunch of bullshit. ADHD, all these things are kind of Jewish money-making schemes. So there's a lot of stuff there, which it's on my website. There's so many topics. Some of them I've looked at on a single issue basis. There's AIDS. I mean, I've known AIDS as a fraud for very long. I've put some stuff on my website about it, which I think is still quite good. It reads quite well, including the fact that in Africa you get a lot of these people have blood diseases. They have infections with things like malaria and various flies and biting insects of all kinds, not to mention, you know, abrasion, injuries, that kind of thing. And all this shows positive on tests, so-called tests for AIDS, although the AIDS tests are not. They look for proteins. They're not reliable tests. I mean, everybody knows this in the industry. It's just they're keeping it going as just a money-making scheme. Another issue is immunology, and I haven't written on this yet. This is another one of Hillman's things. But immunology relies on the idea of surface receptors, the idea of there are receptors in cells. And Hillman has produced good evidence that this is all bullshit. The cell surface is pretty much flat. There's no room for receptors. The receptor theory is wrong. So they're barking up the wrong tree. And again, it's a money-making thing. And I've also got a few other things. I've got diet and lung cancer. I've got a link with that, which has been known since the 50s, I think, that some fats are better for you than others. Like the evening primrose oil is based on sound principles. I've got a tape recording I made of the ethanol chap, essential fatty acid molecules chap. So that's interesting. That's worth knowing about. There's another one here is about salt, ordinary common table salt, which was initially emailed to me by a chap called Frank McManus, who's Australian. He actually manufactures salt. So he could be accused of having his own bias. But he makes this salt, crystalline salt, sea salt. And that's a good thing. The point about that is that people talk about sodium and sodium channels, which in my view, again, are bullshit. But the point about sodium is it's got chloride in it, it's sodium chloride, and the stomach contains hydrochloric acid. And the only way you can get that is from salt. So salt is actually absolutely essential. And it's essential in health, and if you cut back on your salt intake, you're going to render yourself liable to diseases of the sort which are taken in with food. So anyway, there's also a thing about climate change. All these things. This was the thing I recorded in 1997. I think it was a chap called John Mason at Kew Gardens in London. When I at the time I lived near there, a masterpiece of a talk. I'd recommend it if you're interested in climate change and the bullshit and the way it was originally started by very crap computer models. I mean, these are computer models 25 years ago when they were not a fraction of what they are now. So that's interesting. And there are another things, organophosphates, that's an insecticide thing, which is another depressing thing to connect it up with BSE. And at the time, they had a public inquiry at the time. I didn't know anything about this sort of stuff, but again, that was headed by a Jew. Krebs, he's the... It doesn't matter who. And at the time, I had no idea that there was a Jewish link, but nowadays, I'd be perfectly happy that his job was to pretend that there was no connection with beef, because they used organophosphate on the insecticides on some cows, which were in a region infested with warble flies in Britain. It's not everywhere in Britain, just some of it. And all the areas that had warble flies were treated with the stuff. And of course, they were all, it damaged them. They had mental, you know, diseases. And in fact, I suspect that a lot of brain disease in people are going to be caused by these things. They're very anxious that this should not be generally accepted or generally known about. So if you read about dementia, it's perfectly possible it's caused by by things like organophosphates, but by poisons which have had a slow effect on people. There's also, I've got material on fluoride. I've also got material on evolution. The Alfred Russel Wallace was as a precursor of Darwin. He got the idea, which Darwin basically plagiarized, although that's perhaps not that important. And I'd like to discuss evolution with people who are anti-evolutionists. It is rather a shame that they don't seem to be able to grasp the issue of it. But anyway, there are these single issue things, and I've got a piece called Science Revisionism on my website, and it's my own personal experiences going over for about 25 years, which start with a chap called Ivor Catt, who was actually very helpful to me. He had a list of people who were science revisionists, some good, some not so good, and he was very valuable to me. He's, in my view, he's kind of got a bit stuck on his own sort of plateau, but in fairness, he's had a lot of effect on me. There's a moon landing and 9/11. For personal reasons, I was splitting up with somebody at the time. I just didn't have any time to pay attention. But generally, all the skeptics are right there. Anyway, so that's science revisionism. There's so much detail I could go on for hours, but I already have. We're past an hour now, aren't we? I don't want to make this too long. Anyway, are you happy with that? Anything to add?
Oh yeah, you did a really great job here, and I think like I said at the start of the show, you got a lot of different concepts and ideas on your website, and it's pretty extensive. And like I said, pretty much anything you can think of is probably on their website somewhere.
It's nice of you to say so. I'm doing my best. I suspect that the stuff remaining to be unearthed, I think there's still an awful lot of it. You know, I mean, Jews have been very busy. I think there's frauds all over the place just waiting to be unearthed. Like, I mean, you know, there's insurance frauds, for example. Anyway, let me just now go through. This is a completely different topic. It's I've got a thing on my site about JADAR, Jewish awareness, people whose JADAR, JADAR, has been switched on. In other words, they're Jew aware, more or less. I've got a list of things. I've added to this for, 2 years, 3 years, there's a whole list of sites which can be clicked through. And I've got five ones which I've counted as 5-star, which are according to Alexa is one of them. There are a couple of sites which I use to estimate their popularity, although I'm not very happy about Alexa. There's another one called SimilarWeb, which seems to be better, but they're not all that concerned with small sites. Anyway, JADAR. And I just want to discuss a few awakened types here who are influential on me or deserve a mention or whatever. And I'll start here with a chap called Roger Desjardins. He's a Canadian, I presume French-Canadian. And he was one of the originators of the whole nuke idea, nuke skeptics idea. And I've got a high opinion of what I've seen of his. But unfortunately, he's not a bit silent. I've got some sympathy. I mean, he doesn't want to be misrepresented, but I think he should put stuff online. In a way, he's one of the most important people of the whole revisionist movement, because nukes deserve proper exposure, and he started it. He's an essential person. I don't know how he came to it. I'd love to know how he came to it, how endogenous it was with him, how much it was his work, but I just don't know. So anyway, that's him. I'll do these in alphabetical order, more or less. The next one that is important to me was David Duke. His My Awakening. I've ordered his My Awakening book, and it's very good. It's very scholarly. He's unusual in going through in detail. And incidentally, it's interesting that he was switched onto this by just one person. I think it was an aunt, something like one person told him, the Russian Revolution, so-called, was a Jewish thing. And David Duke sort of went off a bit puzzled, but he thought, well, I'll check it out. And of course, it was more difficult in those days, but I think he went to a university library, and he did quite a good job. I'm quite impressed with him, so he gets my seal of approval. I don't know if that's any value to him or not, I know, but he was certainly one of the earlier awakened types. A lot of influence, I imagine, in the southern USA. Now, another one, I don't know how widespread this view is, but I like Louis Farrakhan. I think he said he said some quite valuable things. As far as I know, his nation of Islam, if it was his, I believe it was his, I don't know, was the first to expose Jews and the slave trade from original documents, which perhaps wasn't that difficult at the time. All you had to do was look through American newspapers, and you could find these adverts for, you know, Bert Cohen's, Isaac Cohen's Jews for sale next week kind of thing. I must say, I don't know that they'll stick with the name Nation of Islam, because there's a connection of Muslims with the slave trade as well. And I can't honestly believe that American blacks are that keen to bow down to Mecca five times a day. It just doesn't seem very, very, it just doesn't seem.
I think that's more of a, well, I was going to say, I think that's more of a concept is, you know, they don't want to be Christians because that's the white man's religion. So they went out and found something that was a little bit more.
Bit blacker. That's probably true. I'd hope they could have something more sort of more rational, really, and, you know, the black rationalist movement or something. Maybe that's just too fancy, though. Anyway, he was quite. Another one I just noticed recently that you spoke to was this Rhodesian and South African computer chap, the History Reviewed channel. He's got YouTubes, and he's got quite a good. He's got quite a good account of his slow realization about Jews, not just people like Joe Slovo and Mandela, but his realization that a lot of the companies, a lot of the corporations in South Africa were Jewish run or had Jewish people behind them. So I thought he was quite good. I think his websites, his YouTubes could do with a bit of signposting. I think they ought to have you know, a thing at the beginning saying what's on them, because otherwise you're asking people to spend hours and hours just listening to stuff. But anyway, that's my take. But he was quite good. I think the South African whites have got to get their act together. I hope they can come up with something. But he certainly seems to be a good part of that. Now, another one who's important to me was Michael Hoffman II, although he is a Roman Catholic, I can't take that very seriously. But of course, he does illustrate the fact that if you're a Catholic, you've got a motivation for doing research into Jews. They have a long-term love-hate relationship with Jews. I don't know, which kind of swings around from love to hate. And he's very good at doing original research. He's looked up, he's got various things online. This is all in my Jews site right at the beginning of it. I mentioned him as being a good researcher. Although I think he has some weaknesses which are part of Catholicism. For instance, I remember him saying once that Jews ought not to be killed off or killed, because if they are, then they can't be converted, you see. He thinks he'd rather, although Jews, it's ideally suited to Jews because they're skilled actors and they have no problem being dishonest. So being fake converts, as the case of Spain shows, is easy to them. And so I have reservations about Michael Hoffman, but he is good on the whole Jewish ethos, and he's also quite good on secret societies, which, of course, is a difficult issue because a lot of it can be nonsensical. In fact, I looked up myself. I was wondering about this business of what they call numerology. It's not anything to do with algebra or whatever. It's to do with just numbers as signals, and I looked up 18 and 46, Googled them, and of course it was one of the acts. A lot of these people, since the Bible was published freely available, about the only thing they read was the Bible, and 1846 turns out it was a psalm, and it says, you know, the kind of stuff you can imagine about, you know, the Lord will, you know, slash thine enemies into dust, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think there is some rational basis behind this numerology, although I remain to be convinced. Anyway, Michael Hoffman, good film. There's another one here, it's David Irving, whose site is fpp.co.uk. That stands for Focal Point Press. I actually met him. I was at his trial, in fact. I was doing some of his website work at the time. In fact, although I never told him this, he kept me going financially by, not in a huge way, but anyway, for doing some of his work on his website. And he's an interesting case because at the moment there's a Jewish film which isn't yet out called...
Denial.
Denial, yeah, that's right. Mm. With probably going to be all lies or misleading. And this is, as far as I know, this is the first time that anybody alive and kicking has been, and on without internet access, has been there ready to fight back. So I think for once there'll be quite a skilled fight back about this trial. And I was there myself for about a third of the day. In fact, I wrote that. It's on my website. In fact, the only... Now I come to think of it, it was me who got the trial transcripts. They were trying a new system with which the women who were handling it did very well. I was quite impressed, although despite the fact there were several people talking at once in different languages and so on. But I got that onto floppy disks and got copies of it. That's why it's on, probably why it's on Irving's site and my site. He went through it, correcting all the names, in Russian, German, French, what have you. So he's certainly worth listening to. He's a good show. One of my recent YouTubes was on him, speaking about Himmler. Quite a good thing worth watching. Anyway, another one here I've got down here is Mike King of Tomato Bubble. I think he's one of the best revisionists, and he's continually looking up issues in history, particularly American history. There's a lot of stuff on things like the Spanish-American War, that kind of thing. Very good. Funded by donations. I think the others, they vary in their funding. Some of them don't seem to have funding at all, including me. I've hardly ever had any donations, which is a shame, really. Anyway, Mike, I think his site is called Tomato Bubble. I've got no idea why. I think it's a weird name. But anyway, Tomato Bubble, Mike King, he's good. Now here we have Kevin MacDonald of the Occidental Observer. And I think he's very good at it. He's a bit academic. He's interested in doing... He has a typical academic's outlook, you know, that things are only kind of noticeable if they're published and in some academic volume, and he's got his own magazine, his own journal. He promotes a chap called Andrew Joyce, who's an academic in England or Britain. I'm not sure where, possibly in Dublin, I'm not sure. But these have the same kind of bias towards, you know, the number of publications and citations, that sort of stuff. And I think Andrew Joyce is burrowing quite well. I don't think he's really understood the stuff about the highly expensive loans. He thinks of loans in terms of small stuff, whereas princes and, you know, princelings in the Middle Ages tended to borrow things like wars. And of course, if both sides were supported secretly, the Jews could make a lot of money, although of course it was a high risk thing. There must, in my view, there must have been cases where they'd been detected, and condign punishment must have been dished out to them. But anyway, that's Andrew Joyce. MacDonald, in my view, is also slightly... He accepts Jewish bias, even whenever it's in favour of normal Americans. For example, I remember Robert Faurisson, said somewhere that the U.S. Air Force has killed more children than any other organization in the 20th century. And there is material about U.S. Vietnam war crimes and so on. And that's the kind of stuff they tend to... I've posted a few things like that, and they tend to get deleted because, of course, the Jewish view is that, you know, that they don't mention it. It's not mentioned in the New York Times. You know? Or the fact that the US is riddled with corruption. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's more corrupt than Nigeria, but that's not a popular view. I mean, they also banned... I had a comment on ugliness, actually. I thought a lot of Jews are ugly. I mean, it has to be said they are very ugly. And that could be it could have an evolutionary purpose, you know. If you want to remain your own little group and you're hideously ugly, then it could help with evolution. Quite a legitimate point from an evolutionary point of view, but they didn't they it was banned, not necessarily by McDonald. And I think there's another thing that which I ought to mention, which is this guilt idea. Most of the people in the Occidental think that there's a special, that whites are specially guilty, you know. But in point of fact, there are an awful lot of whites who were have been involved in war crimes, you know. They, or for that matter, they bombed Germans, or they hid knowledge of things. Like, for example, Giuliani obviously must know that 9/11 was a fake. And there are all these people in NASA, all these whites in NASA, and there are techies that do media lies, you know, which work for Jews. But there's not the slightest sign of guilt there, of white guilt there. So I think that's wrong. I think he's just got that wrong in some kind of fairly subtle way. But he's good about it. I think he's good in a sense. Do you know the idea of a supersaturated solution? If you have some chemicals which dissolve in water, and there's a normal point at which they start crystallizing, they won't dissolve anymore. But in a supersaturated solution, you get the thing which has more than a normal amount. All it needs is a little crystal or a shape or a speck of dust, and it starts to crystallize out. And I think the Occidental Observer is having that effect. I think he misses out quite a bit of stuff, and he doesn't know about science. But it's crystallizing. It's having an effect of collecting people, like a lot of these sites are, one hopes anyway. Anyway, they're worth a good look. Now, another one that I'd like, that the opinions differ about, is Miles Mather, who's taken advantage of this online stuff on births and deaths and inheritance and so on, and he's gone through a lot of these things. He's got some stuff which is completely new to me. For example, I'll give a few examples here and try and spread them out to sort of triangulate him. There's Lenin as an aristocrat. Now, I'd assumed all this stuff about Lenin being more or less a peasant or whatever was correct, but Miles Mather, by looking at his ancestry, maintains that Lenin was actually part of the Russian aristocracy, in quotes, you know, in the same way that Britain had aristocrats who were inbred with Jews, to presumably to make money as much as anything. In the same way, Lenin, he regards Lenin as being part of the Russian aristocracy, surprising as it sounds, and obviously it will be a communist. If there are any convinced communists left, they would not like that idea, but that was completely new to me, the idea of Lenin as an aristocrat. Another good one is his looks back into US history, and he's worked out that Lincoln was not actually murdered. It was a fake with Booth as an actor, you know, declaiming his lines. And it was faked because Lincoln's party wanted to reign in power, but Lincoln was severely ill, and because of a defect in the Constitution, it was necessary to do that. I won't go into the detail, but that was completely new to me anyway. And he's good on modern stuff, or relatively modern stuff, on Charles Manson, for example, as a deliberate anti-hippie plant, if you look at the evidence for that. Mather is a portrait painter, and he's good on deconstructing black and white pictures. Of course, since the late or second third of the 20th century up to 1950s or so, black and white pictures were the only ones. So you've got all these portraits. Some of them have been sort of faked or pissed about with, but he's quite good at detecting the way light travels. He can tell, because of his portrait painting experience, he is, or claims to be, good at identifying fake pictures, and he's got a hell of a lot of them. So he's good on US stuff, he's good on people, US writers, who are distinctive to the USA. Who are they? Let me think of a few. Jack London, that's right. Jack London is one of them. Jack London as a homosexual, and all this stuff about being a socialist being more or less made up. And older people in the past, Leaves of Grass, you know, Walt Whitman, that kind of thing. And I think the reason that he looks less Jew aware, but I think that's because the US had fewer Jews from the start, apart from the ones who shipped slaves. So So that's he's quite. He's also good on Philips, the Dutch company, and West and East India corporations. He's the first person I've ever seen to write a good conspiracy view of J.K. Rowling as well. Actually, he thinks she's designed to, for basically for damaging effects. But I won't go into that now. It's another long thing. Anyway, right. Another one who, in my view, is quite good is or very good is the New Observer Online. This is Arthur Kemp's website. Arthur Kemp wrote March of the Titans. He wrote, which is about the white race. He did something similar to Kevin MacDonald, only whites rather than books on Jews. And he now publishes a lot of out-of-print books on race and evolution, white history and black non-history, that kind of thing. So he's very good. His first book, this gives you some idea of his science awareness, his first edition of March of the Titans, I think, had on its cover design the moon landings picture published by people like the National Geographic. So there we go. Anyway, he must have correspondents who are around the world, I think, a bit like stringers in the news media. I don't know anything about his other people, but something like that. And, for example, he has pieces which are known locally but kept out by the Jewish media. For example, there's a recent one on Kenya, which is going to expel, I think it's 425,000 Somali, well, they call them refugees. And the point is, of course, if Kenya could do it, so could anybody else, but that's why they don't mention it. And there's another article about illegals, about 20 million illegals from Bangladesh, what used to be Bengal, you know, Muslims in India, and millions of those in a place called Assam. So they're good. They're good at original stuff, and they get quite a they're a sort of five-star site. So I also mention some of the contributors to Nucleus as well. Actually, now I'm here, there's Jesse War was a good. He started it all off, but he's gone off into other things now. The best contributor in my view, along with me, Nucleus was First Class Skeptic. It's also called Priesthood Agitator, but there's an online YouTube with both of us, so I won't say anything more about him. But he's good on looking at old newsreels and deconstructing what was going on there. I mean, a lot of these things weren't filmed where they were supposed to have been filmed, and the huts they were in were the wrong huts, this sort of thing, and the thing was too light, and the aerials didn't work. He's done some very good stuff on nukes. There's a chap called Verioc, I should mention, a French chap, who was very good on Jewish stuff. That's V-O-E-R-I-O-C. V-O-E-R-I-O-C. Now, and he was the first one to look at the numbers needed for Jew control of the country. He reckoned 10,000 or 20,000. And so he doesn't accept the conspiracy theory that it was all done by a small number, by Illuminati. There just aren't enough. So he's got a quantitative reason for identifying Jewish power. There's another one called Exorcist, who is relatively new, who's been in Britain. But I don't know if he's been active. He was quite good, but I think he's maybe just got fed up or something. And I've got a few more here. Let me see. I've got Michelle Renouf, Lady Michelle Renouf. She was blacklisted. She was a model. She still is a model. She was blacklisted. She makes her own videos. She was awakened at the David Irving trial, and I think also by getting a theology degree. She studied some of the stuff about Jews, so she's quite good. I don't know what she's really up to. There's another chap here, a chap called Simon Shepherd, who wrote on race. He's got a website, I think it's called heretical.com. He ran a chap called Luke O'Farrell between about 2005 and 2008. And he's a good writer, O'Farrell. He's gone, I don't know, underground or gone quiet. They were both jailed in the USA. Although I'm told all they had to do was claim political asylum. I don't know if that's true. I wouldn't like to have tried it. But at any rate, Luke O'Farrell's gone quiet. And Shepard, interesting, because he's got all this stuff on race, mostly anti-black stuff, really, about things like cannibalism. He has, in my view, not very good on women. He doesn't seem to realise that they have serious reasons for taking sex seriously. And there's an interesting point about him. He seems to claim that women caused the First World War. He hasn't. This is something I only twigged myself recently, that suffragettes were used as a fake. There are a lot of cases of suffragettes being accused of crimes. For example, there was a place in Glasgow, a sort of Crystal Palace, a building that was blown up, and there was a letter, a note or something found there saying votes for women, and of course they blamed the suffragettes. But I think that's obviously it's a false flag. It was a Jewish thing. I mean, you're not going to find Victorian women going around, you know, playing around with nitroglycerin. So I think he's wrong about that. It just shows how you learn. I mean, this suffragette thing really was new to, like, 6 months or something, I think it was to me. And I've got another here's Friedrich Tobin of the Adelaide Institute, who's an Australian who still seems to be going strong. He was good on things like the Russian Orthodox Church. Tens of thousands of churches were blown up by Jews, and icons were destroyed. They used to be in every home in Russia, more or less. And now they're very rare. He's got his own archive of nearly 1,000 newsletters, so Adelaide Institute is worth looking at. I've got here, I was going to mention, Western Spring. They want to try and build up based in England, they want to try and build up a financial base from donors until it builds up economic power in the way some insurance companies have. I don't know whether that's likely to be successful, since it doesn't tackle the main problem of Jews printing money themselves. Anyway, that's a quick run through these revisionist awakened types and Jadar, and I also mentioned, well, of course, there are trolls. I've got a site called Joff, which has two meanings, but it's the only thing I could think of to represent the opposite of Jadar. These are Jewish sites. These are sites who deliberately keep Jews off the radar, and there's loads of them. That's people like Pat Condell is one example. I've got down some names here. I can't even remember who they are. Ezra Levant, Mike Cernovich, oh, Alec Jones, yeah. Paul Joseph Watson and others. You know, there are also, in fairness, there are people who are ought to be mentioned, but they are just innocent. For example, I've got a piece on dyslexia by Mona McNee. It's on a YouTube and also on my website. And she just doesn't understand that if some public money is wasted, the people who actually get the money, the recipients, are going to support it. So she was quite good, but she was completely innocent about this Jewish thing. Okay, you're still awake there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. What's the time now? Christ, it's 1 hour, about 1 hour 37 minutes, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll try and keep it down to within 2 hours. Let's see. Okay, ruling. I want to try and discuss ruling ideas. I think are things going to change? Can they change? I think I was originally tempted to compare all this with the Reformation, but the Reformation is too kind of Jew tangled. It may be that the Renaissance is a better model. The Renaissance happened after the Jews were removed from a lot of Europe. There's another example that occurred to me actually with belief in witchcraft, which until about the middle of the 17th century, it suddenly dropped. Before that, quite a few people believed in it, and after it, they just didn't. And I think that there may be a parallel there with belief in Jews and all this Jew stuff. It may just suddenly, for no very obvious reason, just decline and fall. And when I say witchcraft, I'm using this in a European sense. I think Europeans are probably genetically more intelligent than blacks, and I think that blacks believe in things like, you know, the cutting out the atlas bone of a child as having magical powers. I think Europeans are too, it's just not something that would appeal to them. They're more practical and practice, and you know, they've learned to have done things which work. So European witchcraft is a more subtle thing. So anyway, that's what I'm saying. Maybe it'll decline. I wanted to also point out this thing that we tend to assume that science is scientific method and so on is established and it's a definite victory. But this Jewish parasitic approach with just repeating lies and lies over and over again and getting all your friends to repeat lies, it has been very successful. It's been very, you know, there's no question, particularly with sort of thick people, but it's also been successful with people who are presumably count as intelligent. And so there's no guarantee, in my view, that this Jewish thing won't work. It could be that it'll fail. You know, there's a race between science and you know, Jews, and they might win enough to cause enormous damage. And you know, the Black Hat Jews. I've got to, there's quite an interesting video, the debate American Science, our top orators, and it's this debate, so-called debate with blacks. It's almost laughable, but there you go. So. So anyway, it's another interesting thing that occurred to me is what Jews feel now they've got a country supposedly of their own. I mean, I don't know if it can survive. It's funded more than any other country in the world. It's got vast money going into it. And Jews have got used to being feeling contempt for other countries. If you read any novel about America, Britain, France, they're full of hatred for these countries. But now they've got their own country, and which is I've never been there. I imagine it's just another country. All the building techniques, everything's copied from other countries. There's nothing original there. A lot of brothels. It's, you know, women have to go in the back of buses. It's a shithole, you know. So are the Jews who going to notice that and take action? I don't know. Maybe. And but there is another point here, which social scientists ought, in my view, to do, which is to look at more abstract power. You know, there are groups A and B. You know, one of them may fight. And you get, if there's A, B, and C, you get alliances. You get secret funding, which adds a complication, which should be involved in game theory. And I've got some of this on my website. I've got an attempt to consider revision of a whole load of topics. I've tried to go through everything, including economics and all the sciences. So, you know, who knows? Maybe somebody will pay attention. And now, so the final question really is, you know, what the fuck to do? What to do about it? And there is a starting point to look at Jewish techniques and try and use them on themselves. And their techniques. One of them is money and fraud. The answer obviously is to remove or prize out due control of housing trusts, which of course are used in immigration, and corporations and weapons and the money supply. Get rid of all that. And they're also, another thing of course, is the compensation. They're always going about compensation, and whites and others should presumably be compensated too, presumably in kind, because obviously Jewish money isn't worth anything. And so money and fraud is one thing. Another one is this divide and rule idea. Look for divisions between Jews and amplitude, you know, drive in wedges. And this is particularly true where there's an exit strategy. I mean, the Hollow hoax is obviously threaten some Jews with repossession and get them to fight other Jews. Or there are other issues like non-white invasion. There must be some serious discussions about Jews, all the sex with children, the Talmudic thing, there must be stuff there. So maybe that can be used, or for that matter, Jews internationally. Jews traditionally have the policy of controlling news in, say, the USA and the USSR, and printing different stuff in each country. So the USA hates Russia, and Russians hate the USA. Yeah,
and I noticed a lot lately, it seems like a lot of leftist Jews are pretty much becoming more and more anti-Zionist.
Whatever, if you can generate a difference, then that's fine. And anyway, so that's another thing, is divide propaganda, try to oppose Jews in education, get them out, get Jews out of fake research, expose fake research, try and control the media more. And aim at, for example, black Jews or Jews in different European countries and try and interpose wedges there. Right. Anyway. So there's also the issue of violence. Jews use violence usually through, you know, intermediaries, usually through proxies or hired thugs or druggies or whatever, or blacks is another one. I mean, there are 40,000 white women raped each year by blacks, all encouraged by Jew media. That has to be stopped in some way. Not, I don't know how, but it's got to be stopped. There are other possibilities like homeschooling. I mean, if you're, every homeschooler should have somebody telling them about Jews. They don't have to agree with it or not. And there's also home computing. Actually, there's a bit on my site about giving computer hints. It's just simple stuff about HTML, no WordPress, no Joomla, not even any JavaScript. I mean, the idea being that however much these other things change, it's likely to remain viable longer than any other. However much WordPress has changed, all the browsers have changed, plain HTML is likely to work. And there you go, that's the end really. I want to finish there now really. I'm sorry I've been so, I hope I'm not too muttery and mumbly, but there we go. Do you want to kind of round it up? Are you happy with me stopping here?
Oh yeah, yeah, you were doing a fine job. And you weren't mumbling or anything like that at all. I mean, you know, some people, you know, Americans, you're like, oh, I can't understand his accent, but... That happens sometimes, and I hear people say crap like that, and it's just like...
No, it's okay. Do you know where Peoria is?
Yeah.
Ah, there's a joke in I don't know where, in the media about the man from Peoria. You have to aim it at the man from Peoria. I thought isn't it in your area? I don't know.
Yeah, it's in Illinois.
Illinois, yeah. Well, there you are. It's aimed at you. It's aimed at you and the man from Peoria. Yeah. Hey, I've got a... Have a cup of tea or something. It's nice of you to, nice of you to invite me, and I'll try and do more and more of these things. I haven't done one for a couple of years, and I thought, you know, the time has come. Maybe I should get back. And so thanks, and I'd sign off there. I don't want to keep waffling, but thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, well, thank you for coming on. I actually appreciate you coming on and giving us a lot of your insight on your website there.
Plenty more there. Plenty more. Anyway, that's the end. So thanks and bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah.